Thank you. So be sure to check the website for the list, for your name on the list, and what time and place you should go to for the exam. It's not good for you if you come to the wrong place or the wrong time. I'm going pretty fast now. I don't think I'm giving you here in the lecture, which I said in the beginning of the course, is the framework, sort of. I'm giving you a way to be able to learn the material by doing the problems. So you should be doing the problems. There's probably more than you can handle at this point. There's the set 3R, which is the review problems from the first three sets, including 1, 2, and 3. So don't forget those as well. There's a practice exam from a few years ago, and there's now up on exam page 1. There's last year's exam without the answers. I'll post the answers shortly. But you should try to do it, of course, just like the problems without the answers. Okay, so what's covered is everything I got to last time, which was through enzyme kinetics, but no enzyme inhibitors, which I'll talk about now. So we're going to finish up enzymes kinetics with enzyme inhibitor consideration right now, but what's on the exam is through lecture 7, which was last time. Okay, so this is what we sort of are left with, this classical picture of V0 versus S for an enzyme that's behaving like a good Michaelis-Menten type enzyme. They don't all look like this, but most of them do. And now we're going to consider not the normal case, but the case when something is perturbing that enzyme activity, and specifically inhibitors. We could talk about activators. There are also activators, but we'll leave that for biochemistry course. And we're going to talk about three kinds of inhibition. Competitive, which is important sort of conceptually and is important for the pharmaceutical industry. Non-competitive, which is not too important, but I put it in just to show it doesn't have to be competitive. Right? And allosteric, which is the most important from the point of view of understanding what the cell is doing. So in a competitive inhibitor simply competes, by its very name, it competes for the substrate's binding site on the surface of the enzyme. So perforce, it looks, it has a structure that must be similar to the part of the substrate, at least this point here on the left, that is being recognized by the enzyme. So that's very straightforward. You put it in the inhibitor, and the enzyme is slowed down because it can't do anything with the inhibitor. If it could react with the inhibitor, catalyze a reaction with the inhibitor just as it could with the substrate, then it's not really an inhibitor, except in special problem situations, it could be considered an alternative substrate. So the inhibitor usually does not react. It sits there, taking up space. So the distinctive thing about competitive inhibition, the way you know it's competitive, is that you can always compete it out. That is, if you add enough of your substrate, then since your inhibitor is competing with the substrate, well, so is the substrate competing with the inhibitor. And you'll have, eventually, if you add enough substrate, the amount of inhibition can be driven down to where it's insignificant. The results for what the V0 versus S kind of curve is, if we have here on the left this blue line looks like without inhibitor, minus inhibitor. We have a regular Michaelis-Menten shape. And if we're at some low concentration, say, of substrate, this is substrate here, and we have no inhibitor, and that's our curve, and now we're over here, say, with this amount of substrate over here on the left at about, 300, and we add inhibitor, we will drive down the reaction because it's inhibiting it, right? So we have this a lot of inhibition. If you add more inhibitor, you can get down to zero, maybe. But as we repeat the experiment with more and more substrate added, just as we would in order to get a Vmax, say, for this reaction, we find that if we add more and more of this substrate at a constant amount of inhibitor, eventually will swamp out the inhibitor and will reach the same Vmax. We'll make the amount of inhibition caused by the inhibitor to just be insignificant in the end. So we can drive the reaction at its Vmax if we just add enough substrate. It might be a tremendous amount of substrate if we have a lot of inhibitor there, but we can do it, at least in theory, right? What about the Km for such a curve in the presence of inhibitor? Well, you see, we had to add, because the inhibitor is there, we had to add more and more substrate to get to this Vmax, and we had to add more and more substrate to get to one half of that Vmax, which is the Km. So if we measure the Km for this enzyme in the presence of an inhibitor, it's going to be higher. So we can just say that in the presence of a competitive inhibitor, the Vmax is, the Km is changed, it's increased. But some little trouble with the Km. The Km is K2 plus K3 over K1. It's distinctive for that enzyme. And so how can we change that? So we're not really changing the Km, we're changing the apparent Km. So often we're careful and say it's the apparent Km, but sometimes we slip and say, well, it increases the Km. But what we mean is the measurement of the Km. Right? So if you have an inhibitor, you don't know how it's working, you could do this experiment, you say, aha, it's a competitive inhibitor. And then we can look at it. We may not know the structure to begin with. It's just some extract of some plant root. What good are these competitive inhibitors? Well, one thing they're good for is drugs. So in the lab notes, I use two drugs that I take, make it a little personal. So in the lab notes, they're both there. I actually take more than that. But this is a famous one, which are the statins, which are the drugs that help prevent the buildup of too much cholesterol. As they inhibit, you could be eating a lot of cholesterol, but you're also making the cholesterol. You need cholesterol for your membrane. So you're making cholesterol, and it has a pathway with all these funny names, geraniol and farnesyl. And you're starting with some small molecules and making a bigger molecule, finding cholesterol. So like the second step in this pathway takes something called HMG-CoA. And what is that? Hydroxymethyl glutaryl. Right, we don't know what that is until I show you the structure, but I'll show you in a minute. And there's an enzyme that's going to reduce it. It's going to add a couple of hydrogens, and you get something called mevalonate. It's just English words. What some people figured out, there was a Nobel Prize involved in this, was how this pathway works, and that you could inhibit it by putting in an analog, something that looks a little bit like the part of the HMG-CoA that binds to the protein. So here's a Zocor, or a simvastatin, which you now get generically. And this part of the molecule is apparently what's being recognized by here's HMG-CoA, right? So you see, if you draw it in this sort of ringish form, it's open over here, it looks like this in the lower left, and the simvastatin just closes up that ring. Maybe that makes it bind even better, because this thing is swinging around, this thing's locked into the way it's probably recognized. And so this Zocor, or simvastatin, becomes a great inhibitor of this reaction. This CoA part is actually a pretty bulky part of the molecule, bigger than the HMG part. Right? It says CoA. It actually has this structure, which we'll see next time. Yeah. But apparently that's not the part, since it doesn't look very much like the bottom part of Zocor, that's being recognized by the enzyme. So you take this in some amount, so the dose is controlled so that you make less cholesterol. You don't cut out all your cholesterol. So the dose has to be tuned and to each individual patient. Now let's consider some other kind of inhibition. If it's not competitive, well, what could it be? Well, we could lump it and say it's non-competitive. So how could that work? Let's start this time instead with, when you do your experiment and you say, well, is it competitive or not, what it would look like if it were not. So if you have, say, some inhibitor, and you add a lot of it, and you do the V0 versus S, and you get nothing. So that's uninteresting. You can't see anything that's going on. So you add less. So let's say you add only a little bit of the inhibitor so that you're driving down the reaction, and you see you're driving it down no matter where you are on this S-curve. It's oblivious. The inhibitor is oblivious to the S. No matter what substrate concentration you're using, it's knocking it down by about the same percentage. So this is affecting Vmax. And if you would add more inhibitor, it would knock it down more. And more, even more. And enough, you'd knock it out completely. So the Vmax is being affected. But if you look at the, let's say in this most extreme case of the purple line here, you're only getting to about a third of the Vmax in the absence of the inhibitor. But your approach to that, one third, shape of the curve is that is your amount of substrate you need to get halfway to this new Vmax is exactly the same whether you have the inhibitor or not. The Km is not affected. So here's just the opposite. The Vmax is affected, the Km is not. Km is this binding business, right? And so it affects competitive inhibition, but this apparently is non-competitive. So we call it non-competitive inhibition. So how could you visualize something like this going on? It's a little harder. Said all that. So not too many examples of these, but this is one. I told you about the active site having two functions, to bind the substrate and also to do something with it. So here's an active site that has a substrate binding site as part of it, and it has somewhat exaggerated here some side chain that's going to participate in the reaction. So for instance, cysteine with this SH. Maybe that H is going to be used to reduce this gray substrate over here. But that side chain of cysteine, CH2SH, has nothing to do with the binding of the substrate. So if you would add an inhibitor, and a general inhibitor, in fact, for sulfhydryls is mercury. Mercury ions will bind to sulfhydryls. This is probably why they're bad for you, right? Mercury. So it will bind to it and prevent it from taking part in that reaction. So the reaction doesn't go on a molecule that looks like this. But the substrate is bound just fine because this side chain, which is being inhibited by mercury, had nothing to do with the binding of the substrate. Now, hard part here. Let's take a snapshot of what's going on in the presence of this non-competitive inhibitor. In this picture, which you also have on, I didn't put it in here, it's on your one of your handouts. So here's our enzyme in gray. Here's the substrate binding site, which is this reverse triangle, the substrate of the yellow triangles. And you have some of the enzyme at any given moment in time that have bound the substrate, and we're going to try and do something with it. And the doing something with it is indicated by this black, supposed to be like a lightning bolt, this black thing over here. Right? This is part of the active site, but not part of the substrate binding site. So over here, this molecule is just fine. It's bound to substrate in the upper right, and it's got its active site. Its catalytic facilitator here working, and you're going to get product out of that. But if you go down one, you see that there's this red non-competitive inhibitor. So the one we're talking about now is bound to that catalytic facilitator. So this enzyme is really out of action. It doesn't matter whether it binds this or not. If you look over here in the lower left, you find an enzyme which is not working because it's got its catalytic part tied up with the red inhibitor. And even though it's bound substrate, it's not working. So these two out of the six have the red non-competitive inhibitor bound. The other four do not. Those other four are operating completely normally with respect to the substrate and the substrate concentration. You have one out of the four being bound at this particular substrate concentration. So it's as if, instead of having six molecules or six moles or or some multiple of that in this beaker working, you only have four of the six. And so your Vmax is brought down from 100% to 67%. Because at any given moment in time, this is a snapshot. So all these ligands, substrates, they are binding and unbinding. But if you take a, if you just average over time, and this is a snapshot of what's happening over time, on average about under these concentration conditions and with this particular enzyme and these particular inhibitors and substrates, about a third of the enzyme molecules are being taken out by the inhibitor. Right? The remaining two-thirds behave normally, and so when you increase the substrate, they respond to it the same way they would in the absence of the inhibitor. They individually are in the, don't have the inhibitor. It's as if they have, they don't have the, they are not subject to the inhibitor because it's not bound. So that's non-competitive inhibition, and so you can tell the difference by running your V0 versus S reaction. You tell whether you have one or the other. One will affect competitive will affect v, the measurement of Vmax. Non-competitive will certainly affect your V and then your Vmax as well. No matter how much substrate you add. Okay, this is also from your handout. It's just summarizing no inhibitor, competitive inhibitor, non-competitive inhibitor we talked about. And now we'll talk about the third, which is the allosteric inhibitor, which is the most interesting. So allosteric inhibition, yeah?
Are there endogenous competitive inhibitors?
Are there what, drugs?
Endogenous.
Endogenous competitive inhibitors?
Yeah, the body makes.
That's a good question. They're endogenous, probably. I couldn't say, like, no. But they're few and far between. Rather, what the cell has done to make use and modulate the activity of these enzymes is use something called allosteric inhibition. Steric is position in space. Allo means elsewhere, somewhere else. So, whereas this, on graphic 11 now, on this blue enzyme on the left, it's active. It's got a substrate binding site by our reverse triangle here. And it's got some other site elsewhere on the enzyme. If there's nothing in that site, it binds the substrate just fine and could produce a product. But if you add an inhibitor which fits just into this inhibitor binding site that's sort of made for it, then the structure of the enzyme changes. There's a, you can imagine that there's a, as this enzyme binds the inhibitor, there's some movement of the enzyme to accommodate it. And this movement, if you think about the way the all the weak bonds in that enzyme are collaborating, cooperating to provide its three-dimensional structure. Now you perturb it a little bit, everything shifts a little bit, and this has a bad effect for the enzyme's catalytic activity. And its new conformation with the inhibitor bound, either the substrate binding site is closed down, substrate can't get in, that's the easiest way to picture it, or, like the non-competitive case, some catalytic side chain which had to be just in the right place to facilitate the reaction is now a little bit too far to work. So it could be that the Vmax is affected, it could be the Km is affected. We have messed up this enzyme, inactivated it by binding this allosteric inhibitor. Why should it have such a site, of all things? And what is it binding, this inhibitor? There's a method to it. First, because this binding site is independent of the substrate binding site, the allosteric inhibitor need not look at all like the substrate, like the competitive inhibitor. It could look like anything else that fits into this site. But it has to be, it will look like something specific. We're not going to, the results on the enzyme kinetics of V0 versus S are complicated, although understood. And we're not going to deal with that here. Rather, we'll talk about the functional consequences of such inhibition. This kind of inhibition is used by the cell to modulate the activity of these enzymes. So although, let's see, do I have a picture of this? No. So you remember all those arrows would represent all those enzymes. So the enzyme is just left to run amok. All these reactions will be taking place the best the enzyme can do with that substrate concentration that's available to it. And But that leads to a lot of inefficiency. You make too much of something when you don't even need it because some other step is limiting. How could you run, you know, a chemical plant that way with all its pipes and vats and substrates going in and products coming out? You would have valves. You would have a computer that tells you, well, you need a little bit more of this, so open that valve a little more. You got too much of this, close that valve a little more. E. coli does all of this, and it does it for a lot of its enzymes, not all of them. But. And they're especially illuminating to see how they use it for biosynthetic pathways. So all these arrows in the cell can be divided conveniently, almost completely, not completely, into two kinds of pathways, ones that build things up, which is the ones I've emphasized, but also ones that break things down, which we'll talk about next time. We'll talk about today. So these are called, the building up ones are called biosynthetic or anabolic, and the ones that break things down are called catabolic. So consider now some of this anabolism. The cell uses allosteric inhibition to feedback inhibit enzyme activity for a biosynthetic pathway. Let's consider, for example, some linear pathway where you're starting with some intermediate P and you're making a bunch of intermediates, and finally V is the end product of some monomer is important. Let's say it's, you know, tryptophan or something like this. If you have a lot of V, because this pathway has been running for a while, right, then there's no point in running it more because you're just building up this V and other things are limiting for the cell. So it's wasteful to take these valuable glucose carbons and make V out of them when you already have enough V. So what's the best way to stop this? You go back and you hit the first enzyme. So you're not going to make any QRSTU or V anymore if you have a lot of V, by inhibiting this enzyme. This enzyme has a substrate P and a product Q, which look not so much like the end product V. But if that enzyme had a binding site for an allosteric inhibitor, and that inhibitor was V itself, then that would be a beautiful system for controlling this pathway, and it's exactly what E. coli has done. It took it several billion years, but it's done it. Those first enzymes in the pathway that had developed a binding site for V, those cells had an advantage because they weren't so wasteful, and they proliferated and selectively survived. What about if you have a branch pathway? It gets kind of complicated. So you start with A, and you go to make the end product G, but on the way, you have an intermediate E, which is the starting point for another pathway and another end product J, or down here, N, for example. Now, if you just use G to inhibit the first enzyme, one here, for A to B, you'd be in big trouble, because although you have a lot of G, let's say, you could be starving for J, and you make things worse by inhibiting this pathway. So you want to be able to let the pathway A, B, C, D, E, H, I, J go forward, even in the presence of excess G. So that kind of strategy for the cell, taking the first enzyme, did not work. And those cells did not survive, compared to cells that were lucky enough to have tried building in a allosteric inhibitor for G just in the first step that's committed to that endpoint, which in this case is 5. And this is what you find then in general. The end products inhibit the first step that's committed uniquely to them in these pathways. And this is how feedback inhibition works. And it's one of the major ways that E. coli could be more efficiently used and therefore grow faster and therefore outgrew its brethren that did not have these kinds of inhibitions built in. It's not the only way, and you'll learn about the other ways from Dr. Moschus. Here's a more specific example of a branch pathway. Glucose goes in several steps of threonine, which is an amino acid that goes to protein. And this next enzyme, threonine deaminase, takes it to this alpha-ketobutyric acid, and you go through some more intermediates, and you end up with isoleucine, another amino acid. And that's it for this pathway. There's two amino acids made. So isoleucine, according to what I said, should inhibit threonine deaminase, and indeed it does. It's one of the first such inhibitions that was demonstrated in the 60s. And if you look at the side chain, you see isoleucine is a completely hydrocarbon, very hydrophobic side chain, whereas threonine has this OH, and is quite a different character, right? So the binding site for the inhibitor has nothing to do with the binding site for the substrate, in this case, of 3-dene deaminase, which is threonine. So, if we have our E. coli making all this new stuff and now controlling it, so that if it's making too much, if it made plenty of isoleucine, it'll cut down its 3-dene deaminase, say. Well, what about if it's made a lot of it, and so it wants to control it that way? Suppose it has a lot of it just from the environment. You just ate this hamburger, you're breaking it down with your trypsin and other enzymes, and you have plenty of isoleucine because it's just coming in from the outside. That is, E. coli in nature does not grow in minimal medium. Or we can take the cells, instead of growing it in minimal medium, which I've emphasized in order to produce the point that everything's coming from glucose, it doesn't have to be that way, and indeed we don't usually grow our E. coli in our labs in such a medium. Minimal medium, we make a rich medium. We give them all the amino acids, many of the vitamins, give them some fatty acids. Why should they bother making all this stuff? We just want a lot of E. coli as fast as we can. Right? So, if it's 60 minutes in minimal medium, if we gave 30 of these monomers to the E. coli so they don't have to bother making them, then if this story I'm saying is right, they should have the advantage of being more efficient and should grow a little faster. So if we give them valine, if we give them isoleucine, maybe they'll grow instead of 60 minutes in 59 minutes. Right? Well, 58 minutes is a little bit more efficient. We give them all, will they grow a lot faster? You bet. They'll grow double in 20 minutes. Some labs have claimed 15 minutes even. The Guinness Book of Records would have 15 minutes, I think. But I've never seen better than 20 minutes. So you give them this very rich medium, which is like chicken soup, and they will do all this business now in 20 minutes. We give them a little help. 20 minutes, a whole new E. coli cell. Okay, so that ends our discussion of enzymes, and that enzymes we see have answered the problem of how can we get these reactions with their big activation energies to go so that we can make a new E. coli cell in 20 minutes. Right? And we do it with these fantastically efficient, wonderful enzymes, which lower the activation energy, and the reactions just go in seconds instead of weeks. But we still have this big problem in that the direction of the we haven't dealt with the direction problem. Enzyme will speed up the reaction in either direction. It will speed it up, but it has no effect on how much of the end product you get. That's determined by what you started with and whether the products are more stable or less stable than the things you start with. If they're more stable, you will go that way. If they're less stable, you will tend not to go that way. Let's go back to our energy diagram for the transition state. This is now sort of a combination. There's the atoms, which is just a thought experiment. Transition state in the absence of a catalyst. Catalyzed transition state lower. None of these things matter. That's the activation energy. What matters in directionality is what you start with, AB, and what you end up with, CD. In this case, CD is more stable. It's lower on this energy coordinate. Then the reaction is going to tend to go from left to right. And it doesn't matter if you go from A to B to C plus D. You could go any way you want. It only matters what you start with and what you ended with. You could go to E and F and then convert E and F to C and D. So it's even more favorable, but then you have an unfavorable step. It doesn't matter. It's A and D. Your question is, are you going to get C and D starting with A and B? You could have 15 steps in between. If the answer is it goes down, yes, it will go to the right. If the answer is it's higher, then you have trouble controlling the direction. If that's the direction you want to go, you're going to have to deal with it. And now we're going to talk about how we deal with it. How does the cell deal with it? This energy difference now we're going to call free energy difference, because that's the amount of energy that you can manipulate. It's the amount of energy that you can do work with, and I don't want to get into the physics of it, but we have to do a little bit. So it's the free energy difference that determines the direction of a chemical reaction. And now we're going to define quantitatively what that free energy is. So, if we start with our A to B to going to C to D reaction, left to right, in this indication, we can associate this reaction with that delta G. Delta G then is the free energy change, which was just that drop we saw on the diagram. If delta G, and I'm sort of repeating myself, if delta G goes down, that is, if it's less than zero, it's negative, then A and B will tend to produce C and D. If it's in the other direction, if it's positive, greater than zero, then C and D will tend to produce A and P. The reaction will tend to go backwards as written. And there's only one other possibility, that if delta G is zero, well, then the reaction is not tending to go in either direction, which is it's at equilibrium by definition. So, you have to then take on faith this equation, which will describe in other terms how you measure what is delta G at any given point in time in a reaction that's going on. And it changes. This formula is made up of two components. The delta G naught, which is the delta G under some standard condition, which I'll describe in a minute. And this other form, which is RT, which are constants. R is a universal gas constant. Let's get all these things down here. And C, D, and A, and B, those are the, in brackets, those are the concentrations of our products multiplied by each other, divided by the concentration of our reactants multiplied by each other at the moment we're considering it. That looks awful lot like the equilibrium constant. But it is not the equilibrium constant in general. It is just how much we happen to have at that moment, then what is the free energy change that's going on? And therefore, what is the direction at that moment of that reaction? R is universal gas constant, which is about 2 calories per degree Kelvin mole, or centigrade is the same. And note that this is calories, so in problems, you're off by a factor of thousands because this gives you your answer in calories, and you have to divide by 1,000 to get kilocalories. T is the absolute temperature in Kelvin, about 300 degrees at room temperature, a little less. Ln is the natural log. And what is delta G naught? Delta G naught is related to what are A, B, C, and D, and it's a constant. It's a constant that you can look up. For A, B going to C, D, you can look up that reaction in a book, and it will tell you what the delta G naught is. Sometimes we abbreviate it because it's hard to write all these CDs, A's, and B's, and we just say Q, which is for quotient. So Q instead of big K, which would be equilibrium constant, would look like equilibrium constant. So we use Q to indicate it's just a ratio. So you can see that this equation then is divided into two parts. There's a qualitative term, delta G naught, which we'll talk about in a minute. What molecules are in play here? That's what delta G naught is related to, and you just not the amounts, so you can look it up in a book. Then what you can look up in a book is what's happening under your condition, a quantitative term that depends on how much of each is present. Josiah Gibbs figured this out. It's in some sense just a construct. It turns out to be useful. We're sort of like manipulating this energy for our own benefit. So it works. It works for telling us directions of reactions. How about this delta G naught then? This is called the standard free energy change. So there's the free energy change, delta G, and the standard free energy change, delta G naught. And we define it. We define it if all the reactants and all the products were 1. You can see it almost from the equation. If they were all 1, C is 1, D is 1, A is 1, B is 1, you have the log of 1, which is 0. And so delta G equals delta G naught plus 0. So it's almost like a tautology, right? Delta G naught is the free energy change when all the reactants and products are 1. And we usually take that to mean 1 molar. We can define it how we want. Say we could make it, if they were all 17 molar, we call that 1, but we're not. We're going to call them 1 molar 1 in most cases, but not all. So, this just shows you how the formula for delta G gives you this. It's the way delta G is defined. Right? Standard condition, all components are 1. the usefulness of this, if we say, well, all the reactants and the products are all at one, it's an unusual and unlikely situation. But if we compare one reaction to another, when all the reactants and products are one, then the delta G naught gives us allows us to compare one reaction to another when A's and B's are different things, right? So given this standard condition, does the reaction tend to go to the right or to the left? And that's very useful for comparing different reactions. We say this one's going to be very, you know, exergonic, at least when everything is one. It's going to be exergonic. Why is this one? It's very endergonic. It's a big positive value for delta G in kilocalories per mole. So that's a great usefulness of this delta G, and why when you write it in a book, people will read it. And it depends, just like with that hydrogen and iodine, it depends on the relative stability of the reactants versus the products. Plus, you could easily measure this delta G naught, because at equilibrium, from this equation, you see that delta G, which equals delta G naught plus RT ln Q, is equal to zero by definition at equilibrium. So these two terms must add up to zero, and delta G naught. and at equilibrium, the Q at equilibrium is the equilibrium constant. Right? That's the one case this quotient. The one case this quotient is the equilibrium constant is at equilibrium when delta G equals zero. So you rearrange these terms, and you get delta G naught equals minus RT ln of the equilibrium constant. You can measure the equilibrium constant by letting the reaction go to equilibrium and then analyzing A, B, C, and D, measuring how much is there. So you can get delta G naught. So let's say, for example, at equilibrium, so I put the eq down here, so it's not just the quotient, you get 2.5 × 10⁻³, just to give you an example. Then if you plug that into the equation for delta G naught, you come out with 3,600 calories, because I just used 300 for the temperature and 2 for the universal gas constant. So I have to divide by 1,000 to give 3.6 kilocalories, always normalized to the per mole of what we're working with. So you see, this is a positive number, and indeed, you have very little C and D from A and B. So for the reaction, A and B goes to C and D, so C and D is on top. If you have a positive value, it's close to 4, you see you have very little C and D tends to form. Or another way to look at it, as you go from A and B to C to D, 3.6 kilocalories per mole must be absorbed in that reaction. So energy is required for this reaction. And indeed, you know, the equilibrium constant is low. One thing that's handy to note, that if the delta G naught for that reaction, A plus B goes to C plus D, is plus 3.6, then if you just turn it around, then all the numbers will just come out with opposite signs. So for C to D going to A plus B, if we prefer to look at it that way, we could say that that's a very favorable reaction, and it has this pretty hefty negative delta G naught associated with it. Cases we won't usually deal with, but just for completeness, all of these reactions are sort of simple, and a lot of them are simple. You have 1A and 1 mole of B goes to 1 mole of C and 1 mole of D. If 1 mole of A and 1 mole of B went to 3 moles of C and 4 moles of D, then we'd have to put those stoichiometric numbers up in the exponent, just as you do for an equilibrium constant. Now, I told you that for most cases, the one is taken to be one molar, that is unity for defining delta G naught, but there's two exceptions. One is for water. Most of these reactions are aqueous that we consider. Water is present at this tremendous concentration, and generally, even if it participates in the reaction, its concentration doesn't change. So we take water at 55 molar to be 1. It sounds like we're cheating, but we're in charge of the rules here. We want to call water 55 1, we can do it. And that's how our delta G naughts are going to be defined. Right? And we all agree to that, chemists and biologists. Right? Water is always 1. Second exception is a little more controversial. We're going to call hydrogen ions when they're involved as 10⁻⁷ molar, which is neutrality, right? pH 7. We'd call that one also. Biochemists will do that. And the chemists don't like this so much because they're always changing the pH, right? But in the cell, it's usually, in most cases, the pH is buffered, that if it starts to deviate from by all these reactions, there are ways to keep the pH at pH 7. So we find it convenient not to worry about the proton concentration. That's not going to change, just like water. It's not going to change in real life. And so we consider that one. In this case, we have to say delta G naught prime to indicate we are talking about the delta G naught when the hydrogen ion concentration at 10 to the minus 7th is considered 1. Distinguish ourselves from the chemists. But we don't talk to the chemists that often, so we don't usually bother with the prime. But in many books, you'll see the prime is used. Sometimes they don't either. But we're always talking about that. Okay, I don't think I'll reiterate that. Let's start talking about the use of this delta G business as we may have considerations of energy requirements for the cell and directionality of reactions. So, all books and all courses at this time invoke the molecule ATP, and it's reasonable. ATP is short for adenosine triphosphate. Here's the structure. It looks pretty complicated. You'll be a lot more familiar with it in another couple of weeks. So it's got this heterocyclic ring. It's carbons and nitrogens with double bonds, and that's connected, I think you can see, to a ribose. There's our sugar. Right? And then from the ribose here, with the CH2 hanging off, we have three phosphates all connected to each other. This bond we've met before, the CH2OH, going to a phosphate, that's a phosphoester. We met it in phospholipids. But this next bond between two phosphates is not an alcohol plus an acid. It's rather an acid plus an acid. And they've lost water between them. And this one, too, and on the right side of this ATP molecule. It's an acid plus an acid. And that's a new functional group, which is called the acid anhydride. And you can reverse this by adding water back to it, which we're going to be talking about. So here's the adenosine part. It could be broken down to adenine, the base, and ribose, the sugar. The two together are adenosine. We don't need to talk about it anymore. We'll just call it A. We're going to talk about this part, the triphosphate. Let's consider the hydrolysis. The reason we're talking about ATP is that it's a mediator of energy transfers in the cell. That may sound mysterious, but we're going to learn about it in detail. There's the dehydration reaction that connects two acids to form an acid anhydride. Let's consider now the hydrolysis of ADP. We're going to add water across, let's say, this terminal phosphate to form ADP, adenosine diphosphate, and PI, which is abbreviation for inorganic phosphate. Sometimes we'll just say P, but we mean phosphate, not phosphorus. So there's the reaction showing some of the structure. And adding the water. Now, if this is the structure of ADP, which I just blocked out this last P, and so it's just adenosine with two phosphates, right? And we can also consider adenosine monophosphate, which is just the a single phosphate. It's all very reasonable. Just put it in there to get the nomenclature out of the way. The delta G naught for this reaction is about minus 7 kilocalories per mole, quite substantial and negative. That is, 7 kilocalories per mole are released when this reaction takes place and your products are ADP and free phosphate. So it's an exergonic reaction. It goes towards the right. And indeed, if you figure out equilibrium constant, it's about 100,000 towards the right. Now, this minus 7 is kind of a critical point that biochemists have focused on because it's somewhat unusually high for breaking a single chemical reaction that's a hydrolysis. Most hydrolyses are less than this. If a hydrolysis reaction results in the release of 7 kilocalories per mole or more, Then it's called, well, that's a high energy bond. It's kind of a misnomer. That bond that's holding the phosphates is no stronger than any other. It's just that particular transformation is associated with a big free energy change. And if you're talking about it, then you find it convenient to indicate that with the abbreviation of a squiggle instead of a straight line. So you could write ATP like this if we're talking about it, which we are talking about. So that this is a high energy bond, so identified by the squiggle. You can rationalize why so much energy is released, perhaps, by saying, look at this guy. He's got these negatively charged oxygens just smack up next to each other. They're under this strain of electrical repulsion, which is relieved once you let this guy go free. Right? You eliminated this electrical repulsion. That's a favorable situation for the molecule, so it's glad to pay 7 kilocalories per mole to have that situation. By the same token, you might consider ADP also has this tension. And if you added water to that to get AMP and free phosphate, then you might expect that also to be a high energy bond. And indeed it is. It's another 7 kilocalories per mole if you hydrolyze the next phosphate as well. So we can write both of these as squiggle. But the last one doesn't have that electrical business. And so if you hydrolyze that one, now you're down more in the threes, minus threes, for hydrolyzing this. It's not a high energy bond. So if we took a 1 molar solution of ATP in a test tube, and I put it here, and I took enough powdered ATP, and then I added water, we would expect to see this energy release, right? Wrong, because that activation energy, right? So it would just sit there, the ATP, right? And we could go for days, and the ATP would be intact, right? So we have to add a catalyst, so say ATPase, that's going to catalyze the addition of water across that bond. So what I'll get is, after a while, after a very little while, if I have the enzyme, a few minutes, all the ATP will be converted to ADP plus phosphate, heat will be evolved, and the products over the reactants will be about 100,000 with the delta G naught of minus 7. Which is, all these things are in problems. We want to now, since I told you ATP is going to be a mediator of energy transfers, it's called the energy currency of the cell, so how can we capture that 7 kilocalories per mole? Well, why would we want to capture it? Let's put it in a situation. Let's take an endergonic reaction and see if we can use that 7 kilocalories per mole in order to get that endergonic reaction to go. We're going to harness the energy. And we look around for an endergonic reaction. We find the very first reaction that happens for glucose when it gets into an E. coli cell is glucose is converted to glucose. There's that glucose 6-phosphate. So you have this ester that's formed. That's the first step in the fate of glucose, no matter where it's going to go, the very first thing that happens. So what's the delta G naught of this reaction? Well, it's like the reverse of this hydrolysis, right? It's plus 3.6 kilocalories per mole. So that's bad, right? We already figured that's something like 2.5 times 10 to the minus 3 equilibrium constant from this delta G naught. You can calculate it from that. And so very little of the glucose will actually be converted. It'll take you forever. We have our reaction that's supposed to give us our energy here at minus 7 kilocalories per mole, and we have this endergonic reaction that's requiring 3.6. So the two together actually come out favorably. It's going to come out negative if we just add them up, and we can add them up. So we can take everything on the left here, consider these two reactions going on in our test tube, ATP and water, glucose and phosphate, and the desired products we're considering, ATP, ADP from the ATP, and the free phosphate, and G6P, that's glucose 6-phosphate from the glucose, and water. You can see that water and phosphate actually cancel out. Right? Now, it turns out that these delta G naughts are completely additive. So if we wanted to consider this complex reaction in theory, right, The delta G naught for this entire transformation would just be the two numbers added together. It would be minus 3.4. So this is good. Yeah. Minus 3.4. So that's all we have to do then. Let's try that. So we'll take our ATP, now sitting in water, without the enzyme, say. And then we add some glucose and some phosphate. And nothing's happening. We haven't had our enzymes. So, okay, we know we have to add the enzyme. So we'll add an enzyme, the ATPase we used before. And we'll add an enzyme that facilitates that really catalyzes glucose plus phosphate, goes to glucose phosphate, we'll call it glucose phosphorylase, right? Putting phosphates onto glucose. Let's say there is such an enzyme, right? That it speeds up the reaction doesn't help because the reaction's not going to go, it's in the wrong direction. But we've mixed the two together. I said this. Doesn't work. What happens is the ATP is broken down to ADP plus phosphate. Glucose is sitting there. Heat is released. Yeah, heat is released. Temperature is going to go up. If I have 1 molar ATP, 1 milliliter solution, figure it out, comes out to 7 degrees centigrade. So instead of 22 degrees in this room, it goes up to 29 degrees. Big deal. All right. Everything's moving a little faster. Yes, maybe reactions go faster at higher temperature. But number one, it's a tiny change in the temperature in the Kelvin scale. And number two, if you're E. coli living in an animal gut, the temperature is controlled at 37. So even though you have more heat produced, that heat is dissipated in animal pants or sweats, whatever, and the temperature is maintained. So you can't use temperature to increase this reaction. So we still wasted our 7 kilocalories per mole this way. This is not a good plan. Still, it seems, having it, we can just couple these two reactions together somehow. That's the trick. So we'll use not those two enzymes, but an enzyme hexokinase, which is the first enzyme to act on glucose. What hexokinase does, it says, that idea of running the two reactions in parallel did not work. So instead, our goal is to get glucose-6-phosphate. Let's keep that as our goal. We have glucose, we have ATP, we'll make a new reaction, a coupled reaction, in which the very phosphate of this ATP, this doesn't go off into water, but is stuck onto this glucose. We'll make a smart enzyme that can do that. Now, these enzymes are great. So why not? It's just a chemical reaction. ATP plus glucose goes to glucose-6-phosphate and ADP. No free phosphates, water is involved, right? What is the delta G naught of that reaction? You know it already. You know it because that's the sum of those two reactions. So you predict it exactly. It's minus 3.4. This reaction has no problem. It's going to go 1,000-fold to the right. Instead of 2 over 1,000, it's going to be 400. 400 to the right. Coupled reactions are new reactions. So this is one of the two major ways then that the cell gets around this directionality problem. And it's often ATP, sometimes other high energy, other compounds with high energy bonds, to make a new reaction that utilizes that phosphate. You say, well, always phosphate involved? Yeah, you gotta figure out a way to involve phosphate, even when the reaction is not going on. So, all of these reactions, many of the steps endergonic, they're somehow coupled to a new reaction that utilizes the hydrolysis of ATP. And that's why ATP is called the energy currency of the cell and why we talk about it first. So, is this problem solved? Well, where do we get the ATP? Well, we can sprinkle a little bit into our minimal medium. Can't do that. It's this minimal medium, only glucose. How do we get ATP in the glucose cells? You have to build it. Well, some pathway. You have to put the adenine, make those rings, put it all together. That takes energy, actually. So, the problem is not so much. It's we used up the energy, utilized the energy from ATP going to ADP, and then we still have the ADP molecule. It's got all its rings and stuff, just missing that phosphate. So the only problem we have is to regenerate ATP from ADP. So we have our pathways. Finally, it's used to drive an endergonic reaction, or hundreds of them. You build up a lot of this ADP. The problem is now to make ATP out of ADP. ADP plus phosphate goes to ATP. If we could do that, we'd be okay, because we could just keep running this reaction on a little bit of ATP, even use some of this ATP that's made to make its own synthesis, which is going to be required at a couple of steps, maybe. So, there's two solutions in nature. Throughout all of nature, basically, two solutions. One, and the most important, is photosynthesis. Use the energy from the sun to make ATP from ADP. And we're not going to cover that. It's more complicated than what we do, which is catabolize, break down organic compounds made by the organisms that use photosynthesis, like potatoes. We can eat those potatoes, get glucose, and use glucose or other organic compounds, break them down, and extract the ability to make ATP out of ADP. We're going to spend a lot of time on that. Once we go through, once we finish lecture 9, then a lot of the same principles that we have learned, you will have learned at this point, will help you to understand photosynthesis. I don't think it's good to start with photosynthesis, better to do it second. And since it's sort of, to a large extent, more of the same, we don't cover it. So, but if you're interested, which you should be, we wouldn't be here without that photosynthesis. You could read the chapter on photosynthesis after we've done lecture 9. Let's talk about glucose catabolism then. This is just a preview. We're going to talk about glycolysis, in which the 6-carbon glucose molecule is broken down to 3, and we're going to get energy out of that. Then the Krebs cycle, in which the 3-carbon guys from glycolysis are broken all the way down to CO2, and we're going to get energy out of that. And the electron transport chain, which is sort of separate from these two, and we're going to get energy out of that as well. So let's go to glycolysis in detail. Two reasons to go into detail. One is, this is a fundamental problem in how to get this ATP, how we're going to solve this problem of directionality of chemical reactions via ATP. So there's the energy consideration. But the other reason is just to give you at least one example of one of these metabolic pathways and just not leave it as that circle with arrows in the E. coli cell, and show you exactly what's going on. So here's from your handout, a well-worn handout. I leave it in a handwritten form. I don't know why exactly. Somehow seems more real. Mostly handwritten. It looks a little circular. It's not. It's just curved, so it'll fit on an 8.5 by 12 by 11 sheet of paper. And it's got about 10 or 13 reactions on here. Here's the glucose that's entering, and we're going to step through it now. Here's the glucose that's entering the E. coli cell. There's that first step, hexokinase. ATP goes to ADP, and you get the phosphate on the carbon 6. It's kind of hard to look at these Hayworth structures. Let's put it... Let's take this stuff out and look at it also on your handout 7.3. The first steps, and let's draw the sugars in their straight chain form. It's just a little easier to look at. And it doesn't change anything. So here's our phosphorylation step, right? So we're putting names on these reactions now. Because we're talking about individual arrows, individual reactions, individual enzymes, and different types of chemical transformations. So this one's pretty easy to understand. The extraction of water and the addition of phosphate. Right? And now we get into an isomerization, glucose-6-phosphate isomerase, or hexose isomerase. And what's happened? The top of this molecule, there's that anomeric carbon, the C double bond O, is going to switch places, become looking more like fructose. In fact, it is fructose. So the anomeric carbon, the C double bond O, goes down to carbon 2, and the carbon 1 becomes the OH. Now, how does that happen? It's not that complicated. It's a matter of, in terms of organic mechanism, which we're not going to be too concerned with. I know many of you have asked me about it. We're not going into that depth of chemistry. This is enough chemistry. That, there's like you add water across the double bond, you take it away then in a different way. You add it one way, and you take it away in a different way. So it's a very small, simple reaction, really. And that's the characteristic of any metabolic pathway. Each particular step is small and reasonable. It's a slight change from reactant to product. But the accumulation of all these small changes will give you glucose ending up as carbon dioxide. So we have now fructose. Still got the phosphate in here, 6-phosphate. But now we have an OH on the top, just as we had on the bottom here, to start off with. And we're going to do the same kind of reaction as hexokinase, except it's now fructose 6-phosphate kinase. Kinase means adding phosphates by using ATP. And now we have a phosphate at both ends. Actually, we're trying to make ATP out of this, and so far we have invested 2 ATPs in this process, so actually it's a losing proposition so far. Now we're at fructose 1,6-diphosphate. Now we have a pretty dramatic reaction, but still just a cleavage of this 6-carbon compound into 2. And again, it's a matter of adding water in a particular way across this bond. This is kind of like not such a favorable reaction, but it takes place. And we end up with, on the bottom here, look, 3 carbons like glycerol. Well, not glycerol, because this is an aldehyde. So it's glyceraldehyde. And it's not just glyceraldehyde, because there's phosphate here. So it's glyceraldehyde 1,2,3. This is the C double bond O. We'll call that 1. Glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. This is named in a very reasonable way, once you know glycerol. How about up here? Less obvious, because you don't know what acetone is. Dihydroxyacetone phosphate, DHAP. Seems a mouthful now, but soon you'll say dihydroxyacetone phosphate. Become familiar to you. Again, 3 carbons. Acetone's got CH3, C double bond O, CH3. That's acetone you take your nail polish off with. Then, because we have hydroxies, if you add hydroxies to those CH3s, because one is still here, one was there, say, you could have dihydroxyacetone. We put a phosphate at one end, dihydroxyacetone phosphate. So once you understand what acetone is, this naming is reasonable too. Now this upper guy here, in reaction 5 of glycolysis, look at the bottom of it. It's got an OH at the end and a C double bond O in the middle, right? Just like this is the opposite of, say, what glucose was over here. Glucose underwent that end of glucose, 6-phosphate, and isomerization. And these isomers, they're not stereoisomers. These are structural isomers. So it's the same atoms, but in a different arrangement. So here, the double bond was moved, C double bond O was moved from the top to the bottom. Here, we're going to move the C double bond O from the middle to the end. Just switch it for these two places. Once we do that, then we have C double bond O down here and an OH over here. This guy's got C double bond O at the top and an OH in the middle, also similarly, and at the end it's a phosphate. So actually, once we've done that, it's glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate upside down. And it's upside down, it's the same as right side up. We just slide it around on the paper, and it looks exactly like glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, because it is glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. So at the end of reaction 5, we have just glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. We started out with glucose, and now we have 2 glyceraldehyde 3-phosphates. And we've cost us 2 ATPs. Let's go back to our... Let's go back to our full handout and consider the next reaction, the fate of glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate now. And this is the most complicated reaction in glycolysis, arguably, and a very important one. This is going to involve an oxidation. And whereas before our oxidation was the removal of hydrogens, we met it for cysteine, going to cysteine, was removal of hydrogen with the electrons, not just protons. And it turns out it's really the electrons that are important in defining oxidation. So we're going to be removing electrons from glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. And so glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, losing electrons, is going to be oxidized. Something's going to have to accept those electrons and be reduced. Whenever there's an oxidation, there's a reduction. Let's look at this reaction in more detail, also on your handout, 7.4a. So to show you that it's an oxidation, so I've colored in some of the electrons here. Glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate and phosphate have a certain number of electrons. I draw your attention to these blue and red ones, right? And then after they're together, we might have, I'm not always sure exactly which electrons are coming from where. I can't remember my organic chemistry that well. But what we end up with is is a free phosphate now, not from ATP, being stuck onto this glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, and two electrons being removed. And two hydrogens are also removed, two protons. And you end up with 1,3-diphosphosomething. Actually, it's you can see COO. This is now an acid anhydride, carboxylic acid and a phosphoric acid. And these two electrons have been not lost, they've been transferred to something else, which is not yet shown. Right? So this is then one product of the reaction. Those are the electrons. What's going to accept them then? And now I've just used P for phosphate, not even PI. It's not PI because it's not free. But if you just put a P there, you can understand it's phosphate without having to draw all this stuff out. That's an anhydride, a different kind of anhydride than the phosphoric acid anhydride we saw earlier in ATP. Mixed anhydride, two different acids. So we need an oxidizing agent to accept these electrons. And here it is. It's called NAD, which is short for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. If you look at these English words down here without a structure, you see there's more to this molecule. This is the business end. But there's a ribose, a couple of phosphates, another ribose, and that adenine again. Right? So there's a bunch of stuff down here, but here's where the electrons are going, into this ring structure with double bonds. We have, and this is positively charged. You have four bonds to nitrogen here, so it's like a salt. There's chloride out here, counter this ion. If you add now the two hydrogens with their electrons from glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, one of the electrons is, both electrons are going to be added to this ring. One of the protons as well is going to be added, and the other proton is going to be just set free into the medium where it joins the other 10 to the minus 7th molar hydrogen ions at pH 7. So both electrons are on here. The double bonds take a different configuration to accommodate these electrons. And now we only have three bonds to nitrogen, so we no longer have the plus charge. The plus charge is over here. So NAD, glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, got oxidized. NAD got reduced. Now you'll see different nomenclatures. You can write NAD, you understand there's a plus there. So you, some places will call it NAD plus to make it explicit. Right? To be fair, what you get is from the NAD gaining its hydrogens, it gains one hydrogen and one proton goes free. So you could say NAD goes to NADH plus H plus. And most books will show you it that way. And that's probably the better way to do it, but I'm just too hard to keep saying it, NAD plus H plus, NAD plus H plus. Or even writing it. So we take kind of a liberty of calling it NADH2, understanding you're all intelligent people who have heard this lecture, and you understand it's not really NADH2, but the other H is free. But that's what we mean by NADH2. So, nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, it's also one of these vitamins. Nicotine sounds like it's bad for you, so I think that's why the vitamin's called niacin. It's just niacin, just this part, then it gets attached to the adenine and the ribose becomes NAD. Okay, so let's go back to our big handout. And now we understand that we need an acceptor of these electrons for this oxidation. We have a free phosphate here, and we end up with this 1,3-diphosphoglyceric acid and NADH2. And look at this. Look at this. That phosphate, part of an anhydride, squiggle. That's a high-energy bond. Right? So, if we have a coupled reaction, we can use this one to drive the phosphorylation of ADP into ATP, and we do it right away. Right? We cash it in. As soon as we have it, we cash it. And we get this guy dephosphorylated at that top position instead of 1,3-diphosphoglyceric acid. We have still a phosphate down here, 3-phosphoglyceric acid, not 1,3. And when we hydrolyze an anhydride, we get back the acid. So you can see the acid is different from the aldehyde here, and that's because an oxidation has taken place. One way to recognize an oxidation is there's more oxygens around the carbon. For once, oxidation makes a little sense. However, we've added another loose end. We borrowed ATP up here, and we have now borrowed an NAD. We can't just add more NAD. We've converted NADH2. We can't just keep adding more NAD. We have a small store of these things in the E. coli cell. But loose end number one was ATP, and that's now we have put in two, and we get out one down here at the end of reaction seven, so we're halfway there, right? No, we are completely paid up because we have two of these 1,3-diphosphoglyceric acids for every one glucose that we had to invest two ATPs. Two ATPs go in here, two ATPs come out here, and we are all paid off, so at least we're even, Stephen, here. But we still have this loose end. We still have I can't believe it. I put new batteries in at the start of this lecture, and it's real hot too. Well, can you hear me in the back? We will eschew the microphone. Let's continue then. 3-phosphoglyceric acid. Let's undergo an isomerization again. Here we have 3-phosphoglyceric acid. We move the phosphate to the middle and the OH to the end, just like some of the other isomerizations. And we have 2-phosphoglyceric acid. Now's the tricky part. We're going to take water off of this in such a way, this OH and this H, so that we now form a double bond here. And we convert this straight line phosphate over here to a squiggle phosphate. So is that sleight of hand? No. The total molecule is about the same total energy. It's just that the perturbation of that structure by hydrolysis of the phosphate from phosphoenol pyruvic acid is one of those reactions that would release a larger packet of that energy in one step than if we had hydrolyzed here on 2-phosphoglyceric acid. So just by rearranging the atoms, we have produced a bond which will release more of energy in one step. We have this squiggle, again, immediately cache it. This enzyme couples, catalyzes the coupled reaction of ADP receiving this phosphate directly from phosphoenol pyruvic acid onto its little body there, and you get ATP. And now we have two of these for every glucose, and so we have two ATPs, and this is now net. And that's the energy part finished. That is, we started with glucose and some ATP. We ended up with pyruvic acid here as the end product for glycolysis and two net ATPs. Doesn't seem like much for all this trouble, but with these 10 reactions, we can run them 3 or 4 times, right? Get more ATP. We can run them 3 or 4 million times. Just, we got plenty of glucose in this medium. I never told you you didn't need a lot of glucose. Most of the glucose in E. coli growing is used this way, not so much for making new carbon compounds. So, we'll continue at this point next time in the fate of pyruvic acid.